This podcast was created in collaboration with Annapurna Pictures and inspired by the film Detroit, in theaters August 4th.
Summer 1967.
Several American cities are in different moods tonight as violence and rioting continues in the summer of 1967.
For some people, this was the summer of love. But for many Americans, police brutality, the broken promise of desegregation, persistent racism, and economic disparity weighed them down. And in Detroit, it all came to a head.
Here in Detroit, a city of war, where snipers hide on rooftops, the violence continues into the fourth day. It is truly the worst civil riot in modern American history.
I'd never heard a tank come down my street, and I was a Korean veteran.
We've got to get out of this area.
I had literally could not believe that in the United States of America,
state and local police,
that police could treat people
against a handful of snipers
the way that they did.
I'm Courtney B. Vance, and this is Rebellion in Detroit.
As many as 38 people have died thus far, more than 1,500 injured. Detroit is still a battleground in some areas tonight.
By the end of the week, 43 people are dead, 7,200 people arrested, and entire blocks of Detroit are burned to the ground. So what really happened that long, hot summer in Detroit and in America, and why? That's what we'll be exploring over this podcast. We'll start at the beginning with the author and historian, Danielle McGuire. Hello, Miss Danielle McGuire. How are you? Hope you're well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Welcome. You know, I'm from Detroit. I was a 7-year-old at the time. I remember the tanks rolling down our street, and I was very into G.I. Joe at the time. I remember I ran up to one of the soldiers. They were rolling down our boulevard. He turned his bayonet on me. My mother and father quickly whisked me back up to our apartment. But what were you doing in the summer of 1967?
Well, I wasn't born yet. I've come to this story through history. I'm a historian of the Civil Rights Movement. I normally study the South, but when I moved to Detroit about 9 years ago, well, one of my friends said, Detroit was the northernmost city of the Deep South.
Everybody came straight up from Mississippi.
That's right. And that racism, Jim Crow, discrimination, police brutality, the Klan even, that wasn't a Southern thing. That was an American thing.
Right. I remember we moved to, my parents finally got a home in a certain area of Detroit, Northwest Detroit. It was all white and a smattering of blacks. And right over that summer of 69, white flight happened. The neighborhood over that summer that we moved in there switched from being all black, white and a few blacks to all black and a few whites. Over the summer of 69, our parents immediately said, we will never get our money out of this house. And when we finally moved my mother out about four and a half years ago, we had to give the house away. We gave it to the church.
And that's the story of so many African Americans' experience in Detroit. There had been white flight to the suburbs as soon as the federal government made suburban homes easily accessible and affordable through federally backed mortgages, which blacks were not allowed to get because the federal government didn't allow private lenders to lend to anyone who lived outside of the green-lined neighborhoods. And green-lined neighborhoods were neighborhoods that were all white.
So it's not a red line situation. It's a green. I'd never heard of a green line.
Well, the green line was the go, right? If it's outlined in green, that's a go for private lenders. They can give those people federally backed loans with long-term repayments and low interest rates, which allowed most middle-class whites and working-class whites to buy homes and start building a nest egg for the future, which many of them would cash in on over time. The opposite was if you lived in a red line neighborhood, which was a neighborhood that had even one family of color. Now, those homes were not green-lighted for federally backed mortgages.
So you're saying it really was a systematic effort to move whites from the inner city out.
Absolutely.
And to hold the blacks right inside the city.
Yes, that exactly.
And then that of course, expanded the boundaries. I mean, because that's one of the things I remember, Ms. Danielle, that Detroit was the fifth largest city in the United States at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was booming. So it was, in that context, it was an amazing place to be back in 67, 68. And as far as you know, what was happening in the country at that time that you think helps explain why and how the violence erupted? Can you give us a backdrop?
So nationally, what you have is rising expectations because of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I think people really thought that that would make a huge difference. And by 1967, it was clear it really wasn't going to get to the gut issues that mattered to people the most, which was access to opportunity and employment, good housing, equal access to really great education. And I think that it also didn't deal with one of the fundamental issues that was left unaddressed by those acts, which was the right to move through the world with bodily integrity. One of the biggest issues in all of the uprisings that swept the country, and particularly in Detroit, was the issue of police violence. Constantly, police were controlling, corralling, beating, stopping, and frisking African Americans in an effort, in some ways, to contain them in those Black neighborhoods and not let them out of those Black neighborhoods into the white neighborhoods. So you had these rising expectations with the civil rights movement. By 1967, you also had, in some places, a rejection of the civil rights movement, a rejection of the idea that nonviolent resistance could win the kind of justice issues that people needed on the ground. And so you also had the rise of Black power. And Detroit was a hotbed for that. The Black Panthers were just beginning to get started in Detroit, but don't forget, Malcolm X was in Detroit. The Nation of Islam got started in Detroit. So there's this long history, both of Black revolutionary politics, Black resistance, and this long history of white violence and white supremacy. What's happening nationwide with the rising expectations and the lowered results, coupled with the Black power sentiment and the revolutionary politics that are swirling through the communities, like all that's happening in Detroit.
So we were talking about you gave us a snapshot of what the city looked like, but what was the racial makeup of its government and police force at the time?
Well, so it's interesting. A lot of people, especially members of the Black middle class or like the leadership class, and certainly Mayor Kavanaugh, they didn't think that there could be an uprising in Detroit, partly because we had two Black congressmen. We had 12 Black state legislators, and we had Nicholas Hood, who was the first African-American on the Common Council in the city. A lot of African-Americans had really good jobs in Detroit, better paying jobs than in a lot of other cities because they worked in the auto industries. Almost 50% of Blacks owned their own homes during that time, which is really different from right now in Detroit.
50%.
Yep, nearly 50% by 1970. This is also one of these wild snapshots. In 1967, on the 4th of July weekend, there was a speedboat race. There's always a speedboat race on the Detroit River July 4th weekend. That year, just to sort of pinpoint how much Black affluence was in Detroit, there were 30 yachts owned by Blacks on the Detroit River in 1967. So you had a Black community that was rising. So there was this sense that Detroit was doing okay, and that Blacks in Detroit were doing okay, but it wasn't everyone in the Black community. And I think that was part of the problem. So, you know, you had the rising expectations of the civil rights movement, and then you had examples of Black affluence that were so close to you, but you couldn't get to it. And the hardest thing during those years was that there had been a number of booms and busts in Detroit related to the car industry. By 66, there were, you know, I think 100,000 layoffs in the auto industry. And you know that Blacks are always first
to go.
Last hired and first fired, right? That unemployment rate increased into the summer of 1967, and the greatest number of unemployed people in Detroit in the summer of 1967 were young African Americans ages 16 to 19.
Wow. Couldn't get a job. 16 to 19. So what was unique about Detroit's rebellion, though?
Well, there was a mini rebellion in 1966 called the Kercheval Incident, very similar to what happened on 12th Street in 1967, but a really different result. Once again, the police are over patrolling the East Side, and there's a group of young men hanging out, and they're young activists. They pull to the curb, they throw the kids against the building, they stop, they frisk them, they mistreat them, they call them names, and a crowd of onlookers begin to get riled up. They start to throw some soda cans, bricks, whatever is available. Before you know it, there is what appears to be a really dangerous situation in the mix. Because it was early in the evening, there were a lot of police on duty, and so they could call for backup. And almost immediately, they were able to cordon off the street, close the entry to the area, and really stop the violence.
So it didn't explode?
it didn't explode. And the mayor was really pleased. He thought that, unlike in some of these other places, Detroit had a ready response to these kinds of tensions, and that, look, we were able to handle it. It didn't get out of control. But African-Americans who experienced that were seething. Here was another example of police mistreatment, overheated response. So by July of 1967, those feelings had been brewing all year. And let's not forget, like, leading up to 67, there are a number of police brutality cases, a number of acts of violence against African-Americans. I think people had just kind of had it.
How did we find ourselves? How did Detroit find themselves the morning of the 23rd? What precipitated the actual rioting, the rebellion, the uprising?
Yeah, that was the raid on the Blind Pig, Walter Scott's Blind Pig. And they raided these kinds of places all the time. You know, Blind Pigs existed because for a long time in Detroit, blacks couldn't go to white-owned bars. And so, you know, they sprouted up organically as a response to segregation. What made the raid on that Sunday morning, July 23rd, 1967, different from what happened on Kercheval Street was that, like Kercheval, the police raided a black space and mistreated the black people who were in there, you know, threw them down the stairs, called them names, pushed people up against the wall. And like Kercheval, a crowd grew outside. The difference was that it was about 3 or 4 in the morning. There was hardly any police officers on duty. The tactical mobile unit wasn't mobilized. And overall in the city, like 1 in 4 officers were on vacation.
They caught them off guard.
And once the people on the street had the sense that they had the police on the run and that they could control those streets for the first time in who knows how long, there was a sense of euphoria that I think was contagious.
And this has been building for decades.
For decades.
They were waiting for this opportunity.
Yes. And add to the fact that inside the Blind Pig that was raided were a number of returning Vietnam vets. So there was a party at this Blind Pig for returning Vietnam vets. They came back alive. People were so happy to celebrate that. And then the police come busting in, as they always do. And a lot of times they paid the police to go away. That night, I think they were fed up. I think that place had been a target for at least a month of police attempts to raid it. And I think Mr. Scott just was done with that. And certainly his son was. And his son would have fallen into those demographics that I mentioned earlier. When the police finally left, I don't think they thought it was going to get as bad as it did. They got everyone finally into paddy wagons. They had to call in backup, which took forever because no one was on duty at that time. Everyone was off, which allowed the crowd to grow larger and to get more heated and more angry. Now, of course, it's way after bar time. Everyone who's home and is up to any good is asleep. And everyone who's left is up to no good, and they're there on the street. This was just recipe for disaster. Once they put the last person who was in the Blind Pig in the paddy wagon, the police left. And as they left, a young man from the crowd hurled a brick into the air, and it came crashing down on the police window, and glass shattered as the car drove away. And the crowd cheered.
It was on.
It was on. And when those officers went to the station to book their, you know, now they had a ton of paperwork to do. They had 80 people that they had arrested. And one of the officers on duty said to a sergeant, he said, "Hey, Sarge, I think there might be a little trouble down on 12th Street. And the sergeant said, "Whatever. You know, you're always causing problems. I'll take a look on my way to church." He came back just a little bit later, the sergeant did, and said to the officer who was still doing his paperwork, he said, "What the hell have you done down there? What's going on?" One of the first fires had started at a shoe store, and all the burglar alarms were going off on the block. So people in the community were calling the police, reporting the burglar alarms. By 8 a.m., there were probably 2,000 people on the street.
So they created a vacuum and left. But they had no idea they had created it.
They had no idea. And then, you know, to try to get police back into the scene to try to control 12th Street, they just couldn't do it. I mean, they didn't have the numbers. Every effort that they tried failed because there were so many ancillary streets cross-cutting with 12th that if the police blocked one corner, African-Americans, you know, and whites who were also looting, I should say, this was not a race riot. They could just duck around through an alley and come back up another way. And so the police were just outnumbered. And that first morning, they were given very explicit instructions not to fire. Very explicit. And they didn't. They were very restrained. Those police officers in the police department, the commissioner, came under a lot of fire from people in the white community saying, if you would have fired on that first day, and a lot of police said the same thing, you know, they said, then none of this would have happened.
What happened at the Algiers Motel in Virginia Park on Wednesday, July 26, 1967, Danielle?
What happened was, I think, a straight-up murder. The Algiers Motel in Detroit was known among the police as a seedy site for narcotics and prostitution. But in the black community, it was like an after-hour spot, in some cases a place for visiting musicians to go and do after-parties or hang out with people in the music industry. In July of 1967, it was also a refuge, a refuge for people who had to get off the streets because of the curfew. There was a report of sniper fire coming from or near the Algiers Motel, and the police used that as a pretense to raid the motel. They stormed through the halls, they busted into rooms, they fired their shotguns and pistols into the walls, into the floor, into the beds, and into three young men, Carl Cooper, Aubrey Pollard, and Fred Temple. They didn't just kill three people, they terrorized the other people there, seven African-American men and two white women who were there. And they terrorized them. They beat them. They threatened their lives. They busted their heads open with their rifle butts. And they played this grisly game with them, making them think all along that they too were going to die. The whole time they were standing against the east wall of the Algiers lobby, Carl Cooper's body was there on the ground. You know, a vivid reminder of the kinds of monstrous violence the police were capable of. When the police decided they had done enough damage, or when they began to be afraid of what they had done, they left. So the survivors of what happened that night went to the families of Temple and Cooper and Pollard, and they told them what happened. Then those family members started to push for some answers. The police never called them and told them their sons were killed. Mm-hmm. They never got a call from the morgue. You know, they had to go find their sons themselves, which in and of itself is a kind of act of terror. Their testimony, and I think really the investigation by the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News, is what forced the Detroit Police Department to, at least on the surface, hold the police officers involved accountable for their actions.
Well, it really lets you know the extent to which they felt they were untouchable.
Absolutely, yes.
Because this had never happened before. This was that the media got it. Well, how did the media report what happened?
Well, you're absolutely right that this had happened before, that police had done these kinds of things before, and that there was absolute impunity for their actions. Absolute impunity. One of the officers involved at the Algiers Motel that night, David Senek, actually killed a young black man the day before. His name was Palmer Gray. And he killed another young man later that week. He didn't get charged with any of those murders. Almost immediately, the police department spun it as a sniper attack and that the police were engaged in a gunfight with a sniper. But when Barbara Stanton from the Free Press went to the motel and looked around, all she saw were bullet holes on the inside. There was no crossfire. And all those bullet holes were aimed in the places where the blood had stained the floor. It was clear to her that the police were lying.
It was assassination.
Yes, and that these young men were killed unarmed at close range, and that it was a murder.
Did that didn't spark the riot, did it? Or was that?
No, that was the third night of the rebellion. And what had happened by that night, and part of the context for the police actions there, is that it had spun wildly out of control, and so that even the report of sniper fire is hard to believe, because so often when you go back and look at the records, what you see are police firing at other police or National Guardsmen, you know, shooting out streetlights, and the guardsmen on the other block hearing the gunfire and then assuming it's sniper fire. So they'll call in sniper fire, and before you know it, a whole SWAT team has moved in on innocent people's homes. What's really crazy is that there are 43 who are dead. So many of them were young black men who were running away from the police. And then the police called them looters and justified those murders. The uprising gave the police a kind of cover for this horrific violence that they committed. It became an opportunity for the police to fire without consequence at young men and women who were running away. People lost their legs. They lost their arms. They lost their everyday reality. They lost their future. There was never any payment for that, no consequence, no justice. For people now to say, it's 50 years ago, you know, it's time to move on. Well, what about the people who couldn't move on? Quite literally because they were dead or because they had been maimed, their lives snatched away from them, the lives that they knew. If we look at the sort of spiraling out of that violence, what you see, I think our generations were traumatized by that.
Is there a legacy to that rebellion that lives on in Detroit? Is there, what do we learn from this?
You know, there was a movement within the Black community after 67 to have some say in how the communities run. Those revolutionaries that we talked about, they were the ones who led this movement. They wanted power. Mm. They wanted power to determine their own lives. And so they wanted a say in how decisions were going to be made in their communities. And in many ways, they succeeded by, you know, electing Coleman Young just a couple years later. In the areas that were most resistant to integration, Coleman Young really came and integrated the city's offices. Detroit is a kind of a mecca for Black politics and Black business and Black life today, I think, because of that push after 67 and before it, right? The roots of it are before it. I think that the impunity for police at the Algiers Motel and that entire week and the years leading up to 67, I think there are a couple different legacies. One is that African Americans waged a battle to try to rein in the police. They really succeeded in integrating the police force in Detroit, which was very segregated in 1967 and is now not. So there's that legacy. But I think one of the other legacies is that because of the impunity, there's this straight line between what happened at the Algiers Motel and what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and in Baltimore, Maryland, and in New York, and in Minneapolis. Because there's never been the kind of accountability for police violence that we've needed and demanded, it continues. If we look at the Kerner Commission, for example, that came out a year later and studied, you know, the causes of these uprisings around the country, the fundamental cause, the primary thing underlying all of it was the inability of whites to see African Americans and people of color as equals. Underneath all of it was white supremacy. And that's a legacy that we're still dealing with. And in many ways, I think the white community has never adequately or really fully attempted to deal with.
Thank you, Ms. Danielle.
It was lovely to speak with you.
It's been a pleasure, all mine.
Wonderful. Well, when you come back, if you need a historian, let me know.
Everybody needs a historian.
Everyone needs a historian.
Danielle McGuire, historian and author of At the Dark End of the Street. Keep an eye out for McGuire's forthcoming book called Murder in the Motor City. Coming up on our next episode...
I was called to work that morning at 6 a.m. that Sunday morning by my sergeant, who told me that the riot has started.
A man who was just a rookie cop when the rebellion broke out, but went on to become Detroit's chief of police and a deputy mayor.
We were told to go out and lock people up, and that was it. I mean...
Literally.
And the way that it was, I mean, there were just so many people that were looting and doing things that you could take your pick.
This podcast was created in collaboration with Annapurna Pictures and inspired by the film Detroit, in theaters August 4th. Detroit is a new film from Catherine Bigelow, the Academy Award-winning director of The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. It tells the untold true story of the Algiers Motel tragedy during the 1967 rebellions in the city of Detroit. Starring John Boyega, Anthony Mackie, and Algie Smith, Detroit is in theaters August 4th.